Welcome to House of David. My name is Julie Eidlett. I'll be presenting for you today a teaching called Marriage Mythology. This is part one in a series. Part one is called Debunking the Myths of Creation. We are coming at this teaching from the standpoint of a couple who has been married for 23 years. We went through 21 years of very rocky, troublesome years because of the teaching that we had received in Protestant Christianity regarding marriage. And so our perspective in doing the teaching is that we're coming from what we were taught that was untrue and debunking them one by one. All right, George Orwell, I didn't find this quote anywhere specific, but 100 people told me that he said, "The most effective way to destroy people is to not deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history." So, for that reason, we are going to be looking at quotes from church fathers, Jewish sources, ancient Jewish sources, and where those two got their thinking from, too. They were influenced by the pagan, especially Greek philosophers. The trouble is with marriage is that we assume our understandings of the text regarding marriage are unbiased. And in truth, we've been finding that they're not. We've looked at our English translations. We've heard what people told us it means and thought, yeah, that seems to match up. But every once in a while, we'll feel really studious and we'll peek into Strong's and see what the Hebrew word meant, and we thought we were doing our due diligence. So look, we're not pointing any fingers here. That's exactly what we used to do, too. We didn't know any better. You do the best you know at the time, and when you know better, you do better. So in the Hebrew roots community, there's been an amazing outpouring of knowledge because Yahweh's restoring his remnant. We're all learning how much we don't know. We're learning how to study. We're learning how to question what we've been taught. And we're at that place where we're willing to just lay everything on the table one by one and say, is this the truth or not? And in reality, after the shock of us all finding Torah, nothing's sacred anymore. But particularly regarding marriage, there are just layers and layers of influence that we never even considered before because we didn't know they existed. What we found is that the translators of our English Bibles and those that developed the doctrines of the church were wearing colored glasses. I mean, they just came to the text with preconceived notions already firmly held that drastically influenced their translations. And we're going to show where they got some of their preconceptions from. They got some from Judaism, I said that already, church fathers, and pagan Greek mythology. Quite frankly, I was a little shocked when I found some of this stuff. There's also some nuanced layers. You know, these are the main things we're going to handle. But there are also other layers and influences like Babylonian mythology affected a lot of these people. But that stuff is just too much. It's outside of the scope of this teaching, so we'll just move on. It sounds funny. Please remove all colored glasses. Failure to do so may result in skewed vision and may interfere with the work of the Ruach HaKodesh, or the Holy Spirit. It sounds funny, but the truth is it takes a lot of focus, concentrated effort to come to the text fresh. I read this Rabbi David Foreman. He calls it the lullaby effect, as in we've heard that rockabye baby song so stinking many times that we can't even hear it anymore until one day we kind of shake our head and go, wait, what am I saying? That's morbid. He says that the stupefying effects of the familiarity just completely anesthetize us. We simply can't see the text anymore because the stories are so familiar. So what I'm going to ask you to do is purpose to see the text without visions of Adam and Eve apple juice and Renaissance paintings and the Precious Moments Bible. You know, it's hard, but it's possible. All right. So I said this already. Because of where we've been, we designed this marriage series around investigating one by one the myths commonly taught regarding marriage. No matter what the cause, whether the reasons these things have been taught were misconceptions or outright lies, just a little confusion, or that blinding deception, it all turns out the same in the end. Deviation from our Creator's design wreaks havoc, on purpose or not, whether we knew it or not. So this is the slide that we'll show each time we're presenting a new myth to unpack. We believe that each of the myths we're going to show are foundation stones for, quite frankly, building a house of cards on sand. Our intention is to show that what we've found as we dug into the Word, because we've been rebuilding our lives on a new foundation that's based, what we hope, is solely on the Word. And it's been life-changing for us. So any one of the myths that we're going to go over, standing all by itself, may not destroy a marriage, but the cumulative effect is devastating on husbands, on wives, and upon both of their walks with Abba. So, all right, we'll break them down, dig into the text, and try to renew our minds one little piece at a time. Myth number one, you have heard it said, the man, Adam, was created before the woman, Eve, showing that the priority and superiority of the man was ordained by God. In other words, cardinal order equals importance. This is the first layer of cards on sand we're going to address. This myth, in particular, might sound like a small little piece, but it is one of the four pillars of patriarchy. Incidentally, it's interesting that this faulty logic was never carried out further, because if it was, we'd be sitting here debunking the myths that cows and chickens were superior to humans. Just carry it out. All right, so these are the guys who canonized the apostolic writings, what we've been calling the New Testament. These guys developed the doctrines of the church, the Nicene Creed, the doctrines of the Trinity, male headship, sin nature, the evil of keeping Torah, etc., etc. These are those dudes. If you've ever delved into questioning any of those topics, you've probably already met these guys. A good number of the church fathers studied in Athens, and they were all well-educated in Hellenism. Hellenism is the Greek mindset. They believed that the classical Greeks could aid in the moral development of children because they, although they were pagan, they still embraced a, quote, virtuous life. Augustine, I know we've heard that name so many times in the churches we've been in. Augustine encountered Greek philosophy early on. He said in his Confessions, 7:20, quote, when I read those books of the Platonists, I was taught by them to seek incorporeal truth. So, and then Augustine, just in his work, City of God, which is kind of a big one, he quoted five Greek philosophers in a positive way. For a creepy little side venture, sometimes go and read how much his City of God sounds just like Plato's, Allegory of the Cave. Sorry, lost my place. Clement of Alexandria wrote in his Stromata, quote, thus philosophy acted as a schoolmaster to the Greek, preparing them for Christ, and the laws of the Jews prepared them for Christ. In other words, these guys had a high regard for the teachings of the Greek philosophers, and the colored glasses this produced shows up in some of the quotes that we're going to see from them. So this is the slide we'll bring up every time we're quoting church fathers. I'm telling you this just so we can see we didn't come to the text with a blank slate. You know, some of this stuff we got from these guys that was handed down to us. All right, John Chrysostom, Saint John Chrysostom, Archbishop of Constantinople, important early church father, preacher, and unfortunately, theologian. His private tutor was Libanius, a self-professed pagan Hellene. He's also, incidentally, one of the strongest influences of anti-Semitism in the church. Let's see what he said. The male sex enjoyed the higher honor. Man was first formed, and elsewhere he shows their superiority. Neither was the man created for the woman, but the woman for the man. 1 Corinthians 11:9. Why then does he say this? He wishes the man to have the preeminence in every way, both for the reason given above, he means, let him have precedence, and on account of what occurred afterwards. All right, St. Ambrose, Bishop of Milan from 374 to 397 AD. This guy had a traditional classic Greco-Roman education, and even when Greek scholars were pretty rare in the West, he studied Greek authors like Philo and Origen and several others. This guy glorified virginity. That sounds familiar because we've all seen what the Catholic Church teaches with the monks and the nuns, etc. To him, virginity was the highest Christian virtue. He advised that marriage was to be avoided like a burden. For those who did marry, He forbade intercourse and any other for any other reason except for procreating children. He never married. He was one of the most influential ecclesiastical figures of the 4th century, according to both the Catholics and the Protestants. So the kind of stuff that these guys are saying influenced all the people who created the doctrines that we learned. Instilling, this is the same guy that converted and baptized St. Augustine. We'll read about him later. He says, man was created outside paradise, whereas woman was made within it. Hence, although created outside paradise, that is, in an inferior place, man is found to be superior, whereas woman, created in a better place, that is to say, in paradise, is found to be inferior. Nice. All right, we're going to look at a myth from Judaism that shows that they also were not immune from wearing colored glasses when it came to looking at the text. Anyone who's ever looked up the Lord issue, as in why do English Bibles not write the name Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, has already seen how much Jewish teachings were influenced by the Church Fathers. Wait, switch that. The Church Fathers were influenced by the Jewish teachings. You knew what I meant. We're bringing in a Jewish perspective also because the Hebrew roots and the Messianic movements have been so drastically influenced by the teachings of the sages. Colored glasses don't come from one single source. Often they're constructed with layers, some from here, some from there. Let's mix it all together and make some new colors. The quote we're going to look at here in particular is from a source that's obviously not scripture, obviously not inspired. It may even be a parody of Jewish folk tales and beliefs. There's no real consensus on the author. It's considered anonymous. Okay, we're not saying here, here is a respected source representing the thoughts of all Jewish people. Don't hear that. We're saying either A, this is a parody based on a Jewish folklore myth, as in there were real myths like this, or else why would it be humor? Or B, this is an actual slice of what the prevailing mindset was in Judaism. Either way, it makes the same case. All right, from Ben Sirach's Alphabet. He then created a woman for Adam from the earth, as he had created Adam himself, and called her Lilith. Adam and Lilith began to fight. Adam said, for you are fit only to be in the bottom position, while I'm to be in the superior one. Lilith responded, we are equal to each other inasmuch as we were both created from the earth. Hey, that's the quote. Here's the story. The myth goes, Yahweh created Adam and Lilith, his first wife, from the ground simultaneously. He used pure dust for Adam, but he used, quote, filth and sediment to make Lilith. They never got along with each other, and they argued because Lilith wanted to have equal rights with Adam. Finally, she flew off and became a demon, and Yahweh made Adam another wife, Hava, or Eve. Only this time, Yahweh decides to make her from Adam's rib so she'd remember her place of submission. We are including it here not because it describes a version of the creation account that includes so much eisegesis as to be laughable, although it does, but because it's a writing that was and still is out there either illustrating or influencing people's thinking. Although the tradition of two wives... Oops, go back. ...appears early on, this interpretation of creation's timeline was not associated with the character of Lilith until the medieval period. Okay, so Babylonian Talmud references this story about 4 times in Mishnah and Gemara, hundreds of years earlier, showing that this is not a new story. The Zohar, the text for Jewish Kabbalah, or mysticism, also takes up the story a fairly good bit. It goes back to even being mentioned in the Dead Sea Scrolls. What's important for us to note is that these extra-biblical events described in this story came from the rabbis not being able to, in their minds, rectify what they felt like was a contradiction between the Genesis 1 account of creation and the Genesis 2. Looked like 2 different stories to them, and what do you do in that case? You don't think, oh, there's something we're missing here. They think, oh, there's details that need to be added to the story. And that's how they got this. All right, Greek philosophy may seem just like history, but it's shockingly more a part of our daily lives than I ever had a clue. In the classical period of Greek history, philosophers were like rock stars. Right? These were the guys that were like celebrities that had groupies hanging on their every word. All right, Socrates came first. He discipled Plato, who discipled Aristotle, who became the teacher of Alexander the Great. And we already know what Alexander the Great did. He spread the Greek thinking over the entire Mediterranean world, Hellenizing both the Jews and the early Christian church. And here's the thing. His goal was not simply military conquest, I want to take over the world. His avowed goal was to spread this Greek thinking and teaching. That's what he was about. So the stuff that he spread included the Greek mythology and all the stories of their gods. Their supreme god, Zeus, he taunted his wife Hera about his sexual exploits. Okay? My kids are in this room, so I'm not going to go into that too much, but he bragged about to her, you know, how he had children with at least 7 other women besides her. One of the quotes that he said to her was, "I shall scourge thee with stripes. Dost thou not remember when thou wast hung from on high, and from thy feet I suspended 2 anvils, and about thy wrist cast a band of gold that might not be broken, and in the air amidst the clouds thou didst hang." It's no wonder that the ancients accepted wife abuse and flagrant adultery as totally normal. Demosthenes, considered the finest orator in Athens, he said this in a speech. Quote, "Mistresses we keep for the sake of pleasure, concubines for the daily care of our persons, but wives to bear us legitimate children." One of the great political leaders in Athens, Solon, he was homosexual. He passed laws promoting prostitution and began state-run brothels to bring in extra revenue. Homosexuality in classical Greek cities was completely rampant, completely legal, and completely socially normal in Greece. Okay, almost all of the democratic rulers in Athens had boy lovers. I'm telling you this because it affects their thinking. Right, and if we're going to be affected by their teaching, we need to know where this stuff's coming from so that we can look at it critically. All right, so the same guy, Solon, also proposed laws regulating the details of the practice of pederasty. Okay, I'm not going to go into the details of that. Everybody here has Google. Okay, I don't recommend any kids looking it up. All right, here's how the society went. Women were kept at home in anonymous seclusion, never going out in public, completely segregated in women's quarters, rarely allowed to even eat with male members of their own family. They were considered at the same level as slaves. They were never free, rarely educated, never an adult. All of this trickled down from the idea that woman was a curse from the gods. All right, side note here. This is a teaching on marriage. Although we'll include information on Greek philosophers and church fathers and the Jewish rabbis or sages or whoever, it's outside the scope of this teaching to do an exhaustive study on each one of the men that we'll quote. Please go do your own homework on this. While not every historian agrees on every single detail of every event, you know, their interpretations are different, we've studied enough to feel confident in the statements that we're making regarding the lifestyles of the individuals we discuss here. If you do your own research and come up with a different conclusion, rock on. The Bereans were praised, right? All right. Hesiod was a Greek poet, a contemporary with Homer. Ancient authors credited him and Homer with establishing Greek religious customs. Okay. Theogony is a large-scale synopsis of all the Greek traditions that were going around regarding the gods. So all this oral stories and stuff, he collected and made it into a huge epic poem that gives all the stories together. Okay, in the story that tells the creation of the first woman, Greek mythology, Prometheus gives fire to mortal man. All right? Zeus is so angry with him that he decides to punish man. So he makes Pandora. Pandora's name means all gifts. She's exquisitely beautiful, bedecked by the goddesses with, quote, sheer guile, not to be withstood by men. This is a quote from Theogony. Quote, "He made an evil thing for men as the price of fire. He made the beautiful evil to be the price for the blessing." He further tells us that Zeus, quote, "made women to be an evil to mortal men with a nature to do evil." So this Pandora, each of the gods had given her gifts in a lidded jar, a swarm of evil spirits that would bring every form of misery to mortal man, diseases, hard toil, sorrow, mischief, Everything bad that ever happened came because of this creation of woman. Also, Hermes contrived within her lies and crafty words and a deceitful nature. The woman took off the great lid of the jar with her hands and scattered all these and caused sorrow and mischief to men. She was told never to open the jar, but because of her unbridled curiosity, she did open the jar. And they teach that all the misery man's ever going to know came from a woman. I don't know about where you've come from, but honestly, that sounds like what I was taught. All right. The church fathers I mentioned earlier said that they thought these Greeks were good for teaching children. Here's another quote from Theogony. For from her is the race of women and female kind. Of her is the deadly race and tribe of women who live amongst mortal men to their great trouble. No help meets in hateful poverty, but only in wealth. And the drones stay at home in the covered hives and reap the toil of others into their own bellies. Even so, Zeus, who thunders on high, made women to be an evil to mortal men, with a nature to do evil. All right, with all that as background information, and I know it was a lot of background, we're going to move on to the first myth. Just to remind you, the myth was, the man Adam was created before the woman Eve, showing that the priority and superiority of the man was ordained by God. So cardinal order equals importance. All right, we are going to primarily be dealing with Genesis chapter 1, beginning mostly verses 26 and 27. All right. There are two accounts of the creation of humans. I list the scriptures right there. This emphasized importance means pay attention. Okay, in Hebrew, there's no punctuation. Any concept, any word or phrase that's repeated is a technique used to show emphasis. You can't have exclamation points. You can't have italics, anything like that. You just have to repeat the words. In this case, the creation account of humanity is what's repeated. Incidentally, most of the myths that man has claimed as truth come from exactly what those rabbis did with that myth about Lilith, ignoring the first account and focusing solely on the second account, which is easier to twist our presuppositions, you know, otherwise known as colored glasses. The first account is the broad overview, and the second account is the close-up, slow-motion view. All right, we'll start with Genesis 1, 26 to 27. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." So Elohim created man in his own image, and the image of Elohim created he him. Male and female created he them. Okay, so to start with, the words in yellow are what we're going to be investigating in the Hebrew. We're going to start with the first word, man. And Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image." The Hebrew is right there for you to see. That word, aleph, dalet, mem, is the word we're going to look at. It's the missing word is Adam. And created Elohim Adam in image his. Okay, what does Adam mean here? Adam, all right, I'm just going to tell you. The Strong's number is H120. The theological word book of the Old Testament is 25a, just so you know exactly what word I'm referring to. The context here is going to show us that he was not referring to a dude named Adam with a capital A. Okay. I know this is the way it's usually translated, but it's wrong. It's wrong. If Yahweh had intended for us to understand an individual man, Ish, the Hebrew word Ish, is the word that he would have used. It's specifically referring to the earth creature that he created, in whom was all the necessary material to later make male and female. The Strong's and TWOT numbers are up here for Ish, too, so if you need to look that up. The Hebrew word Adam comes from the Hebrew word Adama, which means dust, earth, ground. Okay, the word play in Hebrew is a little more obvious, like the groundling from the ground, the earthling from the earth. So something, an earthling of some sort, was created here, but we do not believe it was a human male named Adam with a capital A. I know that's different than what we've been taught, but keep with me. This is one of those places where we've read the text, heard the text, seen the drawings in our elementary picture books so many times that it's just not fresh to us anymore. It's going to take a good deal of discipline to look at it with fresh eyes. All right, this is a funny little slide. We made it comical on purpose, but really it's about a subject that is far from funny. We'll bring up this slide throughout the series on marriage whenever we come across any little bit of scripture that's been mistranslated or in further parts of the series where extra words or verses have been added to the original manuscript. Somebody messed with it. All right, we're going to look at instances where this was done on purpose, as in these guys knew exactly how something should have been translated, but for whatever reason chose to do it differently. We'll also see instances where the differences in the languages themselves posed obstacles to conveying the true meaning of the text. In either case, we're not attributing motives, as tempting as it is in some of the cases, but we will point out how their mindsets, the paradigms, the worldview of the translators colored their glasses and affected their interpretation of the translations. We're not conspiracy theorists, but we are fruit inspectors, and these things matter. All right, Ha'adam translation issues. Centuries later, when Jerome made his translation, his Latin translation of the Hebrew scriptures, the nuance of Ha'adam was lost. There are no textual means in the Latin language to convey a definite article. Okay, you can't say what this actually means is the Adam. Okay, ha, the. So there's no way to say the in Latin. So, a little side note here. Let me just give a little shout out to all of those that are studying Hebrew, because there's a reason you're doing this. There's a reason that people say that reading the Bible in a translation is like kissing your bride through a veil. It's not the same. So, all right, from the early 5th century, the understanding of the human for Ha'adam was lost from the Western Hebrew scripture because Jerome's Vulgate simply replaced it with the word homonym. And although homonym could mean humanity, it was generally used to designate a single, solitary male human being. So for the average person reading the Latin, they're going to think one male. All right, the Vulgate was a huge influence in shaping the English Bible translations. Sometimes when you have time on Google, you can Google the influence of the Vulgate and see why this was such a big deal. All right, why does it matter? No doubt this contributed to the idea that Ha'adam was Adam, this dude with a capital A, that the feminine was totally absent in the first human creation. It was not. The Septuagint translated it right. They said Ton Adam or Ha'adam, so they got it right. And that was helpful, but maybe not enough. It didn't continue. So the errors in the Vulgate are here, homonym and no the. But then the problem is all these other translations, more modern translations, they are not looking at it straight from the Latin. They're looking at it in the Hebrew, and they didn't translate it right when they could have. Why it matters is this. This contributed to the idea that Ha'adam was some dude named Adam, right? And so without the feminine there, it established in the thinking of the scholars that woman was a divine afterthought, like it maybe even a divine mistake, as if Yahweh, in solving one problem, accidentally created another. So the aloneness of man, he's trying to fix, and he's created a bigger problem, woman. Uh-oh. So, most of these versions translate it as people, plural. When they see the Adam, when they say Ha'adam, they translate it as people instead of the human, which is what it should be translated. Human beings, plural, in the message, things like that. All right, but what we're going to see is that in the context of these verses, this is one entity. Okay, in Hebrew grammar, even when a word describes a thing, like not a person, it appears without the definite article the first time it's mentioned. Okay, that makes sense. And then after that, it does have a definite article. An example is Exodus 25:31. You shall make a menorah of pure gold, and then the menorah and its base and its shaft are to be made of hammered work. Okay, so first you're just saying some random menorah, and then you're specifying which one you mean. It plays out the same way in English. I'm going to make a sandwich, but afterwards I say I ate the sandwich. Small little point, but it matters in the text. In the word Adam here, so Elohim created man in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he him. Adam is the word in yellow. Ha-Adam is the word in yellow. It's spelled with a hey at the beginning, and then the Aleph Dalet Mem. A hey at the beginning means the human. In verse 26, we saw Adam without a definite article, since it was the first occurrence of this word, a menorah, a sandwich, etc. But here, it's made specific with the definite article, the. Before woman is built, Ha-Adam is the generic Hebrew term for humanity that includes both male and female essences. In these verses, the use of the definite article, ha, explicitly indicates that Adam is not a personal name. This human being he's created is the only person in all of Scripture for whom their appellation is prefixed in Hebrew with the definite article ha. Okay? Scripture never speaks of ha Avraham, like the Abraham, or ha David, the David. It doesn't say that. The author here distinctly wanted to show that what he was speaking of was humanity and not an individual named Adam. Every jot and tittle matters, and this is a critical nuance of the sacred text. Why? Because when they translate it to mean one male human, this is one of those cards on sand that they're using to build a faulty foundation. If you have a worldview that says that women are second-class creatures, that man alone was made in the image of Elohim, that this dude named Adam was created first, making him superior, then you need this passage to refer to this dude individually to prop up your case. It may seem like a nitpicky detail, but take a lot of nitpicky details that you don't debunk, and you can build a case that appears to be airtight, especially for people who A, don't know how to dig into the Hebrew, or B, don't have any reading comprehension in English. It matters. All right, we're going to take a quick peek at the missing word here. So Elohim created man in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he blank. The missing word is him. I've heard people say before, see, it says right there, Elohim created him. That means he's talking about the man. Well, let's see. All right, another little mini Hebrew grammar lesson. The use of the masculine pronoun him is a textual necessity. There is no neuter form in Hebrew. There's no way to say it. The masculine personal pronoun is used in every instance where the antecedent, all right, work with me here on the grammar words, you'll figure out what I mean, is not clearly and specifically feminine. All right, let's use a crowd analogy. If there are 100 females and only one male in a crowd, the pronoun describing that crowd has to be masculine in Hebrew. Only if a crowd is entirely female will the feminine pronoun be used. This is the only reason that the word him is used in verse 27. It is not referring to an individual male named Adam. All right, Genesis 1:26 and 27, again. And Elohim said, let us make Adam in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So Elohim created Ha-Adam in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he him. Male and female created he them. There are a lot of interesting words in this passage, but we're going to look at the highlighted ones first. All right, things that make you go, If Ha-Adam means an individual male in this passage, why does the author use the word them? The Hebrew word translated them here is correct. If you try to make the case that he's speaking of humanity in the sense of all the people who will eventually come from Adam, it is not a case that can be made from the text. You have to use eisegesis. Eisegesis is the opposite of exegesis. Exegesis is looking into the text and seeing what it says and pulling it out. Eisegesis is adding into the text, whether you mean to or not. All right, if Ha-Adam means an individual male in this passage, why does the author say male and female? See, that's one of those phrases that historically we just seem to skip right over. As if it's not important, Yahweh just gets a little wordy and he just says things a little weird sometimes, blah, blah, blah. If Scripture intended to indicate that Elohim had created a male being, a man, his addition, male and female created he them, is a cryptic oddity at best, if not utterly absurd. This statement is designed to qualify and explain the phrase Ha-Adam. Later in the creation account, after the woman is built, we'll see that Yahweh is still referring to this male human as Adam or Ha-Adam. In House of David, we've had a very good education and we've done a good job of digging into the idea that a word can have different meanings in different contexts. All right, an example, consider Yom. This is the Hebrew word normally translated as day. Lee has broken this down for us and we've dug into it and we've found it sometimes refers to like the warm, sunny part of the day. Sometimes it means the entire day. Sometimes it means an age. So, in this context, creation before woman is built, Ha-Adam, always and only, refers to this pre-surgery human being. Now, in part two of the marriage series, we'll discuss in more detail the other uses of Ha-Adam. So, moving right along. Next, we're going to look at three words used to describe the creation and forming of Ha-Adam, then the building of woman from that which was already created. All right. Same verse again. We're trying to pull out everything we can out of these because it matters. Every word matters. The first word we'll look at is created or bara in Hebrew. This is Strong's number H1254 and the TWOT number 278, just to clarify. Remember what we said about no punctuation in Hebrew? Here's another example of just how important this account of the creation story is. Three times in the same sentence, the word bara is repeated. It's only used two other times in the entire first chapter of Genesis. Verse 1, Elohim bara the heavens and the earth. Verse 21, Elohim bara the first animate life. We take note here. Remember what I said. It's repeated and repeated and repeated. Bara means created out of nothing. Well, nothing but the voice of Elohim. Ha-Adam, humanity, is created from nothing all at one time. Simultaneous, not sequential. There is no other mention of anything being created, bara, after this point. Everything that will be created from nothing, bara, has been created. At this very moment in the creation account, all the material, every bit of genetic coding that would be required for the whole human race was formed by the hands of Elohim into one ungendered, undifferentiated humanity. All right, here's the next progression in the creation narrative. Our second word in this section is formed, or yatsar. And Yahweh Elohim formed Ha-Adam of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Ha-Adam became a living soul. Strong's H3335, TWOT 898, clarify. It means to form or to fashion, with its primary emphasis on the shaping or forming of the objects involved. So Yahweh Elohim takes what he's already created, the dust of the ground, and forms it into Ha-Adam. We're seeing Elohim embark on a developmental process that involves rearranging existing materials into a new form. Yatsar is translated as potter in Isaiah 41:25 as the potter treadeth the clay. Isaiah 64:8, we are the clay and thou art potter and we are all the work of thy hand. Okay. Elohim was the potter, the earth was the clay with which he formed the human. He did not simply speak humanity into existence. He got his hands dirty, forming the elements that already existed. Next up, made. And the rib which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man, made he a woman and brought her unto the man. the Hebrew word bana, Strong's H1129, TWOT255 to clarify. So, the plot thickens, more details, more specificity in this account. Bana means to build, to erect, as a house, a foundation, a temple, a tower. This word will come up later. A city, walls, defenses, in the sense of a master architect designing and building. Yahweh didn't use this word when he made Ha'adam. He's using this word when he's talking about this final piece of his creation, this woman. This word also means to build a house, as in building a family. Yahweh crafted woman according to a deliberate, specific plan for a deliberate, specific purpose. All right, questions about creation terms. We just read that she was built or bana. The word created, bara, was not used. Or was it? If woman was created, where and when did this occur? Obviously, Genesis 1:27. When? So Elohim created Ha'adam in his own image, and the image of Elohim created he him, male and female created he them. By the time I'm done with this teaching, you guys are going to hear these two verses in your sleep. Okay, the text back in 1:27 tells us that Ha'adam was created. And because we're looking at the context, we know that everything that was needed to build the woman according to the master's plan was included in the Ha'adam. Remember I said one of the meanings of this build was like if you were building a tower. Yeshua said in Luke 14:28, "For which of you intending to build a tower sitteth not down first and counteth the cost, whether he have sufficient to finish it?" If that applies to humans, I can guarantee our Creator wouldn't have missed that concept when he built woman. All right, remember how Yeshua said, "For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished." That's Matthew 5:18. He was confirming the belief of the ancient Hebrews that every stroke of the Hebrew text has significance. When Yahweh formed the animals, he used the same word as he used for forming Ha'adam, but with one significant detail. Yitzer is the word when he used when he formed the beast of the field. Yatsar, very similar, same root word, but the important difference is what he used when he's forming Ha'adam. Remember how we said that repeating a word or a phrase or concept was how he would draw our attention to it? Well, that goes for doubling a letter, too. When used of forming humanity, the word has the same consonants, yud, sadik, resh, but in this case, the yud is doubled. This is a hapax legomenon, meaning that this word, yatsar, with the two yuds, is used in the Hebrew scriptures only once. You know how we like to go and see, where else is this word used so we can get some context and get some meaning for what it means? This is the only place this word's used. The Hebrew sages observe that when a yud is doubled in the text, it generally indicates a spiritual component added to the word. Many of the ancient rabbis, who understood Hebrew, incidentally, much better than us, concluded that this truly was a two-in-one humanity that was formed, with both the masculine and the feminine fully present. As you can well imagine, not a piece of that comes through in any translations. So, you Hebrew students, rock on. Life and breath. And Yahweh Elohim formed Ha'adam of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Ha'adam became a living soul. All right, here's a question. Where did the woman get her breath of life? Does the text tell us? Yeah, it does. This is a beautiful picture of Yahweh imparting his very spirit into humanity. Instead of the word neshama, breath, Yahweh specifically uses the word nishmat, the plural form of neshama. He is breathing breaths into this two-in-one creature. Also, instead of the word chai, which means life, Yahweh specifically uses the word chayim, the plural form of chai. He is breathing lives into this two-in-one creature. And Yahweh Elohim yatsar ha'adam of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breaths of lives, and ha'adam became a living soul. There's a play on words in the Hebrew text. The one God says, let us make humanity, male and female, followed by the detail that Yahweh breathed the breaths of lives into the nostrils of the one Ha-Adam. The word Chaim here also has two U's, that added spiritual component. He doubly formed Yatzar, humanity, and he doubly breathed the breaths of lives into his creation. Let's go back to where we started. All right, the myth was Adam was created before Eve, showing that the priority and superiority of the man was ordained by God. So what we learned is that we aren't quite as far removed from the pagan mythology as we might have hoped. We saw that Ha-Adam in these passages means humanity, not an individual male. We saw how faulty translations perpetuated the myths regarding the creation accounts. We saw why Yahweh called them and male and female. We saw that the text has hints for us to help us understand the true nature of the creature referred to as Ha-Adam, two yuds, the breaths of lives. In effect, we've debunked the myth that Christianity taught us about the secondary origin of woman. Farewell to that. We had heard it said, but may it be said no more in the Messianic assembly. All right, myth number two. You have heard it said, man's authority over woman is illustrated by her being taken out of man, being made from his rib. So the source equals subjugation in design. See what the church fathers say. All right, Augustine. Augustine was the child of a Christian mom and a pagan dad. His dad was violent. He loved his mom dearly, but he believed that her servanthood, her silence, and her absolute total submission and subjecting herself to his fury kept her from worse abuse, and that would lead his, somehow that's going to lead his father to Christ. This guy had a Latin education and later became a student of Mani. And Mani was a Mesopotamian Gnostic teacher. And he learned in that a religion of duality that allowed him to separate the spirit and the body so that it made it a little easier if you want to involve yourself in fleshly activities. Okay, so this is the guy that wrote the first autobiography in Western history. It was called The Confessions. He shared in it his struggles with lust and deeply felt passions. In book 4, chapters 4 and 6, there's an account of a year-long homosexual relationship in Augustine's youth before he converted to Christianity. He then went on to have a child with a woman he never married, a concubine, and then after his conversion to Christianity, he sends her away because she's become an obstacle to his success in his teaching career. So, his mother betroths him to another who's about 10 or 11 years old. So he's got to wait 2 years for her to come of age to marry her. In the meantime, he decides, I'm going to take another lover while I wait for this girl. This is one of the fathers of the church on whom in some of the churches we went to and we learned from, this guy was held up on a massive pedestal. Here's what he says. But the sons of men are born of flesh and blood. Flesh then is put for woman in the same manner that spirit is sometimes put for husband. Wherefore? Because the one rules, the other is ruled. The one ought to command, the other to serve. For where the flesh commands and the spirit serves, the house is turned the wrong way. What can be worse than a house where the woman has the mastery over the man? But that house is rightly ordered where the man commands and the woman obeys. In like manner, that man is rightly ordered where the spirit commands and the flesh serves. In this quote, he's suggesting that when the Apostle Paul spoke of spirit, it always referred to the man, and when we spoke of flesh, he's always talking about the woman. Ah, Clement of Alexandria. This was also a well-educated man who was very familiar with classical Greek philosophy and literature. He was influenced by a Hellenistic philosophy to a greater extent than any of the other Christian thinkers of his time, in particular Plato and the Stoics. All right, some of Clement's most famous works. In Pro Tripicus, he praises Plato's views of God. And Pedagogus, he quotes Homer over 60 times. In Stromata, he tries to show that the Greek pagan literature is actually plagiarized from the biblical prophets. He's a big fan. Here's what he says. Every woman should be filled with shame by the thought that she is a woman. The consciousness of their own nature must evoke feelings of shame. Any wonder why Christian theology teaches what it does about women? All right, let's see what's happening with the rabbis. All right, Babylonian Talmud indicates that when Ha'adam was originally made with a tail, that he was originally made with a tail, but Yahweh used that to make the woman. Talmud says, man was originally formed with a tail like the lower animals, but this was afterward taken from him out of consideration for him. It is written, and the Lord God builded the side, etc. Rab and Samuel differ on the meaning of side. One explains a full face, and the other explains a tail. Either one is a nice, indispensable, unnecessary body part. Who needs it? All right. Rabbi Joshua also goes on to say that, let me read the quote first. Woman was not formed from Adam's head so that she might not be haughty, nor from his eye so that she might not be too eager to look at everything, nor from his ear so that she might not hear too keenly and be an eavesdropper, nor from his mouth that she might not be a chatterer, nor from his heart lest she should become jealous, nor yet not from his hand so that she might not be afflicted with kleptomania, nor from his foot lest she should have a tendency to run about. She was made from Adam's rib, a hidden, modest part of his body, so that she too might be modest, not fond of show, but rather of seclusion. I'll show this other quote later, but he later goes on to say that this was Yahweh's plan in building her this way. However, woman foiled the plan and became each of the things that he just mentioned. All right. Go back to the pagans. Let's see what they say. All right, Plato. Everybody knows Plato. Plato, along with his teacher Socrates and his student Aristotle, helped to lay the foundation for Western philosophy and education models. All right, his work Timaeus. This is The Origin of the Universe According to Plato. It's only males who are created directly by the gods and are given souls. Those who live rightly return to the stars, but those who are cowards or live unrighteous lives may with reason be supposed to have changed into the nature of woman in the second generation. In this situation, obviously, it's only men who are complete human beings and can hope for ultimate fulfillment. The best a woman can hope for is to become a man. So this dude's ascribing the inferior status of women to a degeneration from perfect human nature. Clearly. There's no need for a hell because the fear of being reincarnated as a woman is scary enough to encourage men in right living. Genesis 2:7. This one will be a quickie if we can take off our colored glasses. And Yahweh Elohim formed Ha'adam of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. So, if an entity is designed to be in subjection to its source, doesn't that mean Yahweh planned for Adam to be in subjection to the dust of the earth? Was Yahweh's creation intent for the earth to rule over him? The logic doesn't play out. All right, Genesis 2:21-22. And Yahweh Elohim caused a deep sleep to fall upon Ha'adam, and he slept, and he took one of his blank and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the blank which Yahweh Elohim had taken from man, built he a woman and brought her unto Ha'adam. The missing word is Zelah. In the Strong's, it's H6763, and the TWOT is 1924A, just to clarify. This word Zelah is elsewhere translated side, a side chamber of the temple structure, corners, beams, a flank, as in protecting an army's flank in war. Sometimes people think that this must have been a rib because it says one of his something, so it must be something that he has more than one of. But how many sides does a person have? Instead of the typical story that Yahweh took one minuscule rib from the man, what he actually did was to separate out the feminine half of the Ha'adam he had formed, building woman. Following the surgery, then, both male and female possessed one zelah side of the original undifferentiated humanity. So woman was created from the substance of composite humanity, not from a male body part. Details matter. Okay, mid-16th century, there was an English and German story running around that obviously came from the Talmudic myth. They say that Yahweh originally planned to make Adam from Adam's the woman from Adam's tail, but a dog came along when he turned his back to wash his hands, and the dog ran off with the tail. So that's why he had to turn around and make her out of the rib. This is the word zelah, and there's no other place in Scripture where it is translated rib. Nowhere. All right, bone of bone, flesh of flesh. And Ha-Adam said, "This is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." Adam is using poetic language to describe his exhilarating joy at meeting his other half. This one is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. This shows the value he placed on his new companion. Bone of bones and flesh of flesh can be compared to other superlative phrases in Scripture like King of Kings and Lord of Lords. This was much more than Adam mentioning their conjugal relationship, because in Hebrew thought, soul and flesh were not separate entities. Adam was expressing a mutual oneness in every aspect of their beings. This is also Adam identifying her as his own close relative, but it's covenant language that can be used for people who are not close relatives, beyond blood. So in 2 Samuel 5:1, when Israel made a covenant with David to be their king, they said, "Behold, we are thy bones and thy flesh." In 2 Samuel 19:12, when David made a covenant with the elders of Judah, he said, "Ye are my brethren, ye are my bones and my flesh." Consider Paul's statement in Ephesians 5:30 about how those that are in covenant with Yeshua are, quote, members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. Adam recognized the woman as his covenant partner. All right, back to where we started. Source does not equal authority, but a misunderstanding of source can lead to all manner of doctrinal errors, not to mention crazy stories. It seems like a small nitpicky detail to worry about a rib or a side. Here's the difference. A rib, a tail, those are two very small body parts that don't have any significance. Technically, they are both expendable. They don't affect whether someone lives or dies. But a side, having an entire side taken from you, is monumental. It's life or death. Woman is fully half the substance of what Ha-Adam was. The myth was man's authority over woman is illustrated by her being taken out of man, being made from his rib. We had heard it said, but may it be said no more in the Messianic Assembly. Just a quick reminder before we continue. All right, all of it has the same net effect. Next myth. Man was made in the image of Yahweh, but woman was made in the image of man. Where is this concept found in the text? If we take off our color glasses, we'll see. It's not found anywhere in the Scriptures. Let's see what the church fathers said. All right, Augustine, we know about Augustine. Eisegesis is not a new concept. He said, "The woman together with her own husband is the image of God, so that the whole substance may be one image. But when she is referred separately to her quality of helpmeet, which regards the woman herself alone, then she's not the image of God. But as regards the man alone, he is the image of God, as fully and completely as when the woman too is joined with him in one." All right, St. Ambrose. In Hebrew thought, there is no separation between body and soul. It's all echad. Those distinctions were simply a Greek invention. We already told you who St. Ambrose was. Here's what he says. "Remember that God took the rib out of Adam's body, not a part of his soul, to make her. She was not made in the image of God, like man." All right, Ambrosiaster, work with me here. 4th century church writer, not the same guy as the St. Ambrose above, but this guy's commentaries on Paul's letters was considered a massively important document of the Latin text before the Jerome's Vulgate came out and before Augustine. Here's what he says. Women must cover their heads because they are not the image of God. All right, let's check in with Brother Judah. All right, Philo. Anybody that studied Jewish history has probably run up against Philo before. He's a Hellenistic Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria, Egypt during the Roman Empire. So this is a contemporary of Yeshua, first century guy. His goal was to mesh Jewish mythical thought with Greek philosophical thought. Several Christian church fathers were greatly influenced by him and spoke very highly of him. Jerome, the guy who wrote the Latin Vulgate, he listed Philo as a church father. Let's see what he says. Quote, why does Moses command them to take a perfect male sheep of 1 year? For an imperfect sacrifice is not worthy to be brought to the altar of God. And it is to be male, first, because the male is more perfect than the female. Wherefore, it is said by the naturalist that the female is nothing else than an imperfect male. Nice. This is the follow-up quote to Rabbi Joshua's thing that we talked about earlier. So Yahweh planned for the woman to be taken from the rib to avoid all this, but his plan didn't work. Here's what he says. But woman baffles God's design and purpose. She's haughty and walks with outstretched neck and wanton eyes. She's given to eavesdropping. She chatters slander and is of a jealous disposition. She is afflicted with kleptomania and is fond of running about. In addition to these vices, women are gluttonous, lazy, and bad-tempered. Let's see what the pagans say. Simonides. Simonides of Amorgos was a Greek poet who's believed to have lived in the 7th century BC. Okay. This poem of his on women jokes about each type of woman represented by an animal whose characteristics he believes are also characteristics of the large body of the female population. From the start, the gods made women different. One type is from a pig, a hairy sow whose house is like a rolling heap of filth. Another type the gods made from a fox, pure evil and aware of everything. One type is from a dog, a no good mm-mm, and a woman, a mother through and through. One type the gods of Mount Olympus crafted out of earth, their gift to man. She's lame and has no sense of either good or bad. Another loathsome, miserable type is from a weasel, undesirable in every way, uncharming, unalluring. Another type, a horse with flowing mane, gave birth to. Another type is from an ape. I'd say that Zeus made her the greatest pain of all, his gift to man. Her face is hideous. All right. Simonides left no copies of his works. Only fragments of this guy's poetry survive as quotations from ancient authors. Here's a question. Why would so many other authors quote him if he was just a fringe element and not expressing general sentiment? All right, back to our favorite verses. Looking at the yellow and red letters, Adam in our image after our likeness. We already explained about why it would have been Adam in the singular written in the first usage. Okay, so moving on. Elohim created Ha-Adam in his image. In the image of Elohim created he him, male and female created he them. We already know that Ha-Adam is a unity of humanity, a two-in-one including both the male and the female components. Yes, I'm harping on it. We're going to say it over and over. The author leaves no doubt that both the male and the female are created in the image of Yahweh Elohim, an echad plurality in the image of an echad plurality. All right, I'm going to quote Skip Moen's book, Guardian Angel, here. Because Hebrew has no punctuation, it often communicates emotional tone, emphasis, and linguistic rhythm by providing information in the structure of the language as well as the arrangement of the words. All right, this is a small detail, but it matters. We already know that we know about the Hebrew repetition. This phrase is repeated, so Yahweh can draw our attention to it. For even more emphasis, it's written almost in mirror image with its syntax, so it draws our attention more. All right, work with me on my Hebrew pronunciation. Vayibara Elohim ha'adam basalemvo, created Elohim ha'adam in likeness his. Besalim, Basalem Elohim bara otfo. In image of Elohim created he him. Then one more time that he reminds us that this was male and female. All right, another little mini lesson. Every jot and tittle matters. Yahweh made this language. He could have chosen either masculine or feminine for any given noun. He could have made any noun neuter, but he chose to do it this way. In Hebrew, all nouns are either masculine or feminine. Generally, masculine nouns are concrete, while feminine nouns are abstract. There's something Yahweh wants us to learn from the gender of these nouns. Now, we're going to peek at the words translated image and likeness. Image. Betzalem Enu. So actually, this is our image. Or the root word is selim. Either way, it's a masculine noun. All right. Ketemut Enu. Our likeness. Or the root word is demut. Either way, it's a feminine noun. Could he be any more clear about this? I don't think so. All right. The myth was, man was made in the image of Yahweh, but woman was made in the image of man. See how simple it is when we take off the colored glasses. Yahweh tells us he made Ha'adam, the human unity, in his image and likeness. He reminds us that when he says male and female, he means male and female. He emphasizes male and female by his choice of a masculine image and a feminine likeness. You have heard it said, but may it be said no longer in the Messianic assembly. All right, go on to the next myth. Yahweh gave Adam, the man, but not Eve, the woman, dominion over the earth. So this is the manager plus secretary maid nanny myth. Check in with the church fathers and see what they say. All right, here's Augustine. Obviously, this quote has more meaning now that we know about his early life. He says, I don't see what sort of help woman was created to provide man with, if one excludes the purpose of procreation. If woman was not given to man for help in bearing children, for what help could she be? To till the earth together? If help were needed for that, man would have been a better help for man. The same goes for comfort and solitude. How much more pleasure is it for life and conversation when two friends live together than when a man and woman cohabitate? Two friends. All right, Chrysostom, learned about him before. Interesting about him is he was considered one of the three holy hierarchs and one of the doctors of the church. These titles were given to by the early church to highly influential, this is quote, highly influential bishops of the early church who played pivotal roles in shaping Christian theology. This is what the church says about these guys. Or individuals, quote, whom they recognize as having been of particular importance regarding their contribution to theology or doctrine. He says, it does not profit a man to marry, for what is a woman but an enemy of friendship, an inescapable punishment, a necessary evil, a natural temptation, a domestic danger, delectable mischief, a fault in nature, painted with beautiful colors? The whole of her body is nothing less than phlegm, blood, vile, rheum, and the fluid of digested food. If you consider what's stored up behind those lovely eyes, the angle of the nose, the mouth, and the cheeks, you will agree that the well-proportioned body is only a whitened sepulcher. Incidentally, Chrysostom means golden-tongued. Let's check in with Brother Judah. All right, Shimon ben Yeshua ben Eleazar ben Sirach of Jerusalem wrote the book of Ecclesiasticus. Everybody, you probably know that from the Apocrypha, also known as the Wisdom of ben Sirach. This is somewhere around 200-175 BC-ish. All right, church fathers, Clement of Alexandria, Augustine, and Origen all quote this dude. They quote from this book and consider it on the same level as Scripture. Excerpts from his writings are also found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. He's unusual among the apocryphal writers because he signed his work. He's proud of this stuff. Do not stare at any man for his good looks. Do not sit down with women. For moth comes out of clothes, and woman's spite out of woman. Better a man's spite than a woman's kindness. Women give rise to shame and reproach. All right, so from Babylonian Talmud again. He would also say, One who increases flesh increases worms. One who increases possessions increases worry. One who increases wives increases witchcraft. One who increases maidservants increases promiscuity. Let's see what the pagans say. All right, Aristotle was a Greek philosopher, a student of Plato. This guy's views drastically influenced the Judeo-Islamic philosophical and theological thought during the Middle Ages. This guy, the Muslims called him like the great teacher or something like that. He was very revered in Muslim circles. He was also the private tutor of Alexander the Great. If you ever heard somebody say, well, that's your truth, then you've heard the echo of Aristotle. The world has been eating the fruit of these Greek philosophers for millennia. Here's what he says. Just as the young of mutilated parents are sometimes born mutilated and sometimes not, so also the young born of a female are sometimes female and sometimes male instead. For the female is, as it were, a mutilated male. All right, Genesis 1:28. And Elohim blessed them, and Elohim said unto them, be fruitful, and multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. When Elohim blessed Ha-Adam he had created, he gave him these five parts. Now, let's break down the historically abused term, dominion mandate. All right, forgive my Hebrew pronunciation again. Them, otam, means them, those, etc., a plural, direct object marker. Same sentence, be fruitful, paru, plural verb. Multiply, uravu, plural verb. Replenish, u me mahaleu, plural verb. Subdue, vekibesua, plural verb. Have dominion, aradau, plural verb. And for context, let's review Genesis 1:27. So Elohim created Ha-Adam in his own image. In the image of Elohim created he him. Male and female created he them. Male and female is the them. They have both been given the same blessing, the same commands, the same job, if you will. Co-heirs in the grace of life. All right, let's ask this text a question. Over whom has Elohim given Ha-Adam dominion? Right, fish, well, that just means fish. Birds simply means birds. But what about every living thing? The Hebrew root word is ramas. It means to creep, to move lightly, move about, walk on all fours. It specifically refers to animals. Fish, birds, animals, what's missing? Elohim did not give anyone dominion over Ha-Adam, not even Ha-Adam. You've heard it said, the myth was Yahweh gave Adam the man, but not Eve the woman, dominion over the earth. This is the manager plus secretary maid nanny myth. We saw how Elohim gave the blessing and commands to be fruitful, to multiply, to replenish, to subdue, to have dominion equally to all that was Ha-Adam. We noticed how no dominion was given to Ha-Adam over any part of Ha-Adam, just animals. The text is clear, it's just the colored glasses that were making it hard to see. You had heard it said, but may it be said no longer in the Messianic Assembly. Soren Kierkegaard, 19th century Danish philosopher. I will say this, even though I'm not a fan of the pagans, I will say, truth is truth no matter the source. The reason I fuss about the pagans is because it's not truth. Kierkegaard said, indeed, one can be deceived in many ways. One can be deceived in believing what is untrue. Can anybody say, been there, done that? But on the other hand, one is also deceived in not believing what is true. So, the Bereans searched, go thou and do likewise.